Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, January 6, 2013. Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont, has popped the question we've been asking here for months.
Your metadata fills us in on who you are and where you've been. On all your secrets, all your sins.
Just trust us.
I don't have anything to hide. Finally, some musical satire about the NSA surveillance scandal. And I cannot 100% verify this, but the YouTube video, and I'll link to it in the show file for this podcast, it includes great video send-ups along with this happy little tune. It bears the fingerprints of one Victoria Parks of Columbus, Ohio. Victrola is one of her nicknames, and that is one of the handles linked to this YouTube video. And back in the Bush era, Victoria was very busy producing politically infused tunes. And so again, I'm not 100% that this is a product of her twisted mind, but that is my solid hunch. And as we set up our podcast with this happy little song called Just Trust Us, Bernie Sanders, the independent senator from Vermont, fired off a letter to the NSA and got a pretty quick non-denial denial. He asked the question that we've been posing and pressing since Russell Tice disclosed to me and Sybil Edmonds this past June, that he individually participated in the wiretapping of important leaders, including Senator Feinstein, the chair of the Intelligence Committee, an up-and-coming senator from Illinois at the time named Obama, members of the Supreme Court, the FISA Court, key leaders of the House and Senate. And finally, Sanders put that question directly to General Alexander at the NSA. Has the NSA spied, or is the NSA currently spying on members of Congress or other American elected officials, asked Bernie Sanders. Well, on Saturday, the NSA offered this squishy statement. NSA's authorities to collect signals intelligence data include procedures that protect the privacy of U.S. persons. Such protections are built into and cut across the entire process. Members of Congress have the same privacy protections as all U.S. persons. Let me repeat that. Members of Congress have the same privacy protections as all U.S. persons, which means zero, zilch, nada, bupkis. Now, I hope that there is a firestorm on Capitol Hill. I hope that those suited, mostly wealthy individuals who purport to represent us finally get furious when their own self-interest is affected in this manner. I really hope so. And I hope this will fuel the efforts to provide some real reform to the rogue intelligence collection, not just at the NSA, but across the entire intelligence community of the United States, including, and often most significantly, the FBI. And so I'm really grateful to Bernie Sanders for having the cojones to bring up this question. As you know, I've tried every way I can to get members of Congress. I talked to Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon. He's known about this since he met me at Netroots Nation back in June. Also, Keith Ellison, progressive member of the House from Minnesota. He's been aware of it since then. Mike Honda, Democrat from Silicon Valley. He's known about it. But it took Bernie Sanders, who is not afraid to take on the Obama White House. He's really a fearless man, and I have known the senator for many years now, have a very high regard for him. And Bernie, thank you. Thank you for asking that question, and I hope you will be relentless as usual in not only seeking out an honest answer, but in providing true reform, real reform, not the Feinstein reform bill that embeds, that legalizes the illegal actions that have been going on. And meanwhile, the debate continues in this country after, coincidentally, the New York Times and the British newspaper The Guardian editorialized within about a day of each other, calling for clemency or some sort of a plea bargain with Ed Snowden. Both news organs flatly saying that he is a whistleblower. And in an interesting matter of kind of balance or fair play, in Sunday's New York Times, in the news column, not on the editorial page, they assigned Peter Baker to kind of balance the editorial page. And so the article opens up to the prosecutors pursuing him. Snowden has committed espionage by divulging national secrets. But the growing backlash against government surveillance has spurred a spirited debate about whether he should be forgiven. And the article even notes the separation between the editorial pages and the news department at the New York Times. So they begin with a quote from Jesslyn Radack, a whistleblower herself, used to work in the Bush Justice Department, blew the whistle when they were busy shanghaiing John Lind. And so they quote her first. I think the tide has changed for Snowden. All the things taken together counsel in favor of some sort of amnesty or pardon. And then they lower the boom with former CIA director John McLaughlin, former top spook Michael Hayden, who ran the NSA before he ran the CIA, before he became the director of national intelligence. And Hayden has been out there quite a bit on the PBS NewsHour and other programs in recent weeks, trying to spin up the report from the handpicked Presidential Commission of Insiders. And he keeps saying that no abuses have taken place. This whole thing is abusive. It abuses our Fourth Amendment rights. There is no question about that. The president repeats the mantra, oh, there have been no abuses. I mean, that is so fatuous, it's hardly worth mentioning. The other defender of Snowden they trot out is a man who, in my estimation, has soiled himself, Bruce Fein, whom I once respected. When he spoke out as a Republican against Bush and Cheney, called for their impeachment. But he wound up for a while as the attorney for Ed Snowden's father. There was some weird shit going on about that. And in the last few years, I've learned more about Bruce Fein, whose day job is that he's a top lobbyist for the government of Turkey. And he's knee-deep in nefarious deeds in that respect. So I don't have a great deal of overall respect anymore for Bruce Fein, but he does come to Snowden's defense. He said that the First Amendment prohibits government from punishing communications that expose government lawlessness, whether or not the illegality is classified. Calling government to account for breaking the law is a compelling civic duty of all citizens. Well, Bruce Fein, I agree with you on that one. Now, I just learned just moments before I sat down behind the microphone here that there is a bill that has been introduced in California to basically nullify any actions of the NSA in trying to spy on Californians. And this is a very encouraging development. And Ted Lieu is a member of the State Assembly from Southern California. And he is carrying this legislation. Now, I've just read it over once, so if you will permit me, I'm going to do more research. I've invited one of the proponents of the bill to come on a future podcast. And so we'll give you more information about that when we have it here and have been able to analyze it more fully. Now, Glenn Greenwald has played a central role in facilitating the revelations of Ed Snowden. And I'm going to link to his most recent post, dated today, January 6th, as well as a very critical reporting on Glenn Greenwald and his new business arrangement with Pierre Omidyar by my friend Sibel Edmonds at Boiling Frogs Post. Now, first to Greenwald. In a very lengthy post, which is addressed to an unnamed reader who had emailed him, he responds to many of the questions that have been raised, most notably by Sibel Edmonds, but he doesn't mention Sibel or quote any of her allegations in particular. But he goes to great lengths to point out that he is not a partner in the new media entity that is being started by Pierre Omidyar. And he offers detail that I hadn't seen before. For example, that Omidyar's company was actually on the drawing boards before Jeremy Scahill, Laura Poitras, and Glenn Greenwald decided to build their own media outlet. And when they found out what Omidyar was up to, they decided to join forces with him. But Greenwald is very explicit. I am not a partner in the new entity in any legal or financial way. The journalism company that has been created is a nonprofit, and I own none of it. There is a separate tech company created to build privacy technologies, encryption. It's for profit, and Greenwald says, I own none of it, and the same is true for Poitras and Scahill. So he goes on to define this relationship as not really different from what he had with The Guardian of Britain or Salon.com. He says he has a written guarantee of journalistic independence and that he has the right to post any article without interference from Omidyar or other executives of this new organization. He also points out, and I think this is very important, that he is not the exclusive holder of all of Snowden's purloined files. Poitras has a complete set. He says Der Spiegel has a complete set. Apparently, incomplete sets are held by the New York Times and the Washington Post and perhaps some other media outlets. And First Look is the name of the new media outlet. It'll be primarily online that Omidyar is founding, and clearly, Greenwald will be his star reporter. But the implication that came from my friend Sabel and other people, that he is somehow monetizing or, you know, using this trove of Snowden's documents to hand them over to Pierre Omidyar, who has dubious credentials as a free speech advocate and a media owner. And Sabel has done a great job of teasing out the history of Pierre Omidyar, which is quite troubling. But I have not seen any evidence so far that actual conflicts have arisen. And Greenwald goes into great detail. I can't quote it all for you here in the time that we have. But I hope you will read it and hear out his point of view. And the other thing that I'll say, and I, again, believe that Sabel Edmonds is well within her rights to report what she has, to delve into issues. Her latest post raises really obvious questions about why Greenwald's partner, his gay partner David Miranda, was so obvious in carrying flash drives with the secret information from the NSA, going through Heathrow Airport where he knew he was likely to be subjected to heavy surveillance and searching. And it turns out, and Sabel reports this was news to me, that David Miranda had the encryption codes, the passwords, to the secret files that he was carrying on flash drives, written on a piece of paper that was in his pocket or in his personal effects. So that suggests a level of carelessness or some secret desire to be caught. I can't explain those issues. But for me, the bottom line is the issues of Greenwald and Poitras and Pierre Omidyar, I believe, can be sorted out later. Right now, I'm not very intent on trying to smear or criticize Glenn Greenwald. I'm most interested in reforming the NSA in this country. And that's what I'll continue to focus on. And just in case people start to, you know, buzz or have any other theories, there is at BoilingFrogsPost.com a video of the Boiling Frogs Roundtable that includes Guillermo, James, and Sabel. And I was scheduled to be a part of that conversation, but the scheduling got screwed up, and so I wasn't available at the time they recorded that. And Sabelle is aware of my concerns and my point of view on this. And so I just want you, the listener, to know that it's all out in the open. And perhaps at a future time, Sabelle and I will air that out in more detail. I'm grateful for the people who support this program, which includes many great Americans and people from all over the globe. Nobody named Coke, though. Andy Bettmanis is a monthly subscriber, so is Teresa Paris and Linda Gray, and Bob Getzla, too. Every month, they send me $5 to support the work I do here at peterbcollins.com. And I invite you to join their ranks. Just go to my website, peterbcollins.com, right under the mugshot of yours truly on the homepage. There's a link that says sign up. You follow that. Open up your account at PayPal. You choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever you can afford, whatever you feel is appropriate. You can cancel that subscription at any time. The best deal, though, is our $50 annual subscription, which comes complete with a bonus book to be named, and we have renewed our kick-ass Kona coffee offer. There is a box of coffee beans on its way from the Big Island to me right now. So if you sign up for a new subscription, I'll be happy to bag up some beans and send them to you along with your bonus book. The other way you can support us, whether you're a subscriber or not, is to go to peterbcollins.com, and on the left-hand page, left-hand side of the homepage, there's an ad for audible.com. You click on that, and you can sign up for a free 30-day trial. And for doing that, you get to choose a free audiobook download from the 150,000 titles at audible.com. They'll play on your iPhone, Android, Kindle, MP3 player, whatever gizmo you've got. And you can cancel that trial subscription anytime within 30 days, and you won't owe them a penny. But whether you stay with them or you cancel, Audible will pay me $15 for each trial membership. And quite a few people did this over the holidays. Thank you. You're next. Please follow the links at peterbcollins.com. No, we don't get any money from the Koch brothers here. Not like the right-wing national radio shows from Rush Limbaugh on down, and we'll get to them in a moment. But together with the Center for Responsive Politics, the Washington Post today published a very important piece. Actually, it was published in their Sunday edition on January 5. And what they have done is painstakingly figured out this maze of organizations the Koch brothers have created to take the money of wealthy people and use it in what is called dark operations. Dark because we don't know who gave the money or how much. And following the Citizens United decision, the Koch brothers have gone deep. And I'll link to this article. It is a must-read, and it comes complete with a graphic that maps out the web of these organizations. You've heard of FreedomWorks. Well, they get a lot of money out of the Koch brothers. Americans for Prosperity, oh yeah, they're still at the trough. But the organization I want to draw your attention to among all of these is called the Center to Protect Patient Rights. It's nominally based in Arizona, and in 2012 it was used to launder the source of $11 or $12 million that was dumped into the California campaign cycle just a month before Election Day. And they were trying to defeat Governor Brown's tax increase, which balanced the budget of the state of California and put us on a path to solvency for the first time in years. And they tried to defeat a pro-labor ballot measure that was on the same election cycle. Now, what is interesting is that the Koch brothers spent $407 million. Now, that's not all entirely their money, but the 17 conservative groups that made up their network spent over $400 million. Karl Rove's Crossroads GOP group ran about $325 million. Unions put in $400 million. And wealthy Democrats in the Democracy Alliance spent about $100 million. So if you add it all up, The dark money was $700 million plus for Republicans, about $500 million for the Democrats. And what's very interesting is, at least so far, that the Koch brothers didn't get much for all the money they spent. Very few of the elections, I think only one or two of the Senate races came out the way they wanted. And so it is interesting because I shudder when I see all of this money being pumped into electoral politics. Most of it is being spent on negative ads attacking what's left of liberals, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. Moderates called liberals in today's language. And the other issue is the Koch brothers, who represent the wealthiest people in the country. They claim that they need to keep the money secret because there's so many dangerous opponents out there who issue death threats and want to do them harm. And I just think that is so fatuous. Because these people live in their gated communities with security teams, and what they're really trying to do is wage a class war. And they have been doing it. So far, they are winning handily. Now, as you may know, the Koch brothers are poised to profit from shale oil, from fracking, from all types of extraction of carbon-based resources. And our friend Steve Horn at the Smog Blog has broken another big story. You may know that at the end of December, a freight train exploded in Castleton, North Dakota. There's a massive fire. Maybe you saw some of the footage or still photos from it. Well, you got to know the connections here. It was Warren Buffett's Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad that was hauling crude through Castleton when those tanker cars blew up. And what Horn discloses is that when you move shale oil, they add a chemical cocktail to it to liquefy it, so that it's not just real thick sludge. And what Horn points out is the company that was having the oil shipped to it, called Marquee Missouri Terminal LLC, was just incorporated 2 years ago by Marquee Energy. It filed in September 2012 a permit application disclosing that they were going to be shipping shale oil into their facility in Haiti, Missouri, right on the Mississippi River. That's where they transfer it from rail cars to barges after, in many cases, flaring off these dangerous chemicals. Now, flaring is very risky to any humans who are nearby because what they do is just burn this stuff in the air. They burn it off. Well, the hazardous air pollutant permit explains that Marquee knew there will be evaporative losses of toluene, xylene, hexane, and benzene from the crude oil handled by the installation. Benzene is a known carcinogen. The others are dangerous, volatile chemicals. And so this just shows how much the industry knows what it's doing and how little the American media covers these issues. And from there, how ignorant the average American is about what's going on. Now, I talked about the influence of the Koch brothers, particularly on right-wing talk radio. And today I got another in a series of increasingly shrill emails from Laura Ingraham. Laura's one of the few female hosts on the right. And she's not a bad radio host. She just has really ugly politics. So the letter reads, "Fellow Patriot, Barack Obama and his gang of radical liberals have launched an unprecedented campaign targeting conservative talk radio. Their goal? To shut down the public debate by silencing our most effective conservative spokespeople. The left knows they can't compete with conservative arguments about the economy and foreign policy. That's why they're trying to cut the mics of our most effective spokespeople, including Rush, Glenn Beck, Roger Hedgecock, Peter Schiff, and myself, and effectively tape our mouths shut." Now, what becomes clear is that this is a fundraising appeal. They're appealing to the ignorance of the consumers of right-wing talk radio, suggesting that it is somehow threatened. And their rationale is that Obama has finally gotten three people appointed to the Federal Communications Commission. And simply because Obama appointed them, they are radical liberals who are going to eviscerate the free speech rights of conservatives. This is pure bullshit. The guy Obama appointed to head the FCC, I have outed as the worst appointment of his presidency. Tom Wheeler, former lobbyist for the cable television industry before he became the lobbyist for the wireless telephone industry. Two key elements under the regulatory control of the Federal Communications Commission. And there is currently an initiative launched, I believe, by a Republican member of the FCC who wants to revitalize AM radio, which is the home of all these right-wing creeps. Not only that, many people have just noticed that where they used to have a spot on the AM dial where they could hear Randy Rhodes or Stephanie Miller, Tom Hartman, Ed Schultz, Norman Goldman, Mike Malloy, New York, no longer available. Los Angeles, off the air. San Francisco, Randy Rhodes, the only survivor of a huge format shift here, where the station that used to be all liberal, that was once the Air America outlet, is called 960 The Patriot. The announcer says, always right. So, this just points out how detached from reality these conservatives are. They love to play the victim. The real victim in all this is my friend Nicole Sandler. Nicole's got a Facebook post up right now asking her fans, friends, and listeners if she should continue with her daily live streaming radio show. Nicole is a great progressive. She's a really talented radio host. And I don't presume to give her advice because I've been in this situation where you really want to keep doing a show, but you can't afford to do it. You've got to make a living. The costs of doing it are greater than any revenue you can generate. It is not easy for Nicole or me or anybody else. And so don't just click like if you see that post from Nicole Sandler. And don't just say, oh, hang in there, Nicole. Tell her you'd like to subscribe. Tell her you have a friend who would like to advertise on her streaming radio show, radio or not. See if there's a way you can help her continue to do the work that we all benefit from. Now, here is another concocted fight that the right is engaging in here in California after their hateful efforts to roll back Proposition 8, or actually to keep it in effect. They passed Proposition 8, which took away the rights of same-sex couples to marry. So they've given up on that, and now they want to fight over transgenders and school bathrooms. Because last week, a new law went into effect in California, the first in the nation, that requires public schools to let children use sex-segregated facilities like restrooms and locker rooms based on their own gender self-identity. And this is being played by the religious right as something that's really scary. Oh, there are going to be boys who identify as females using the girls' bathroom or locker room. Now, who does that threaten? It only threatens insecure people. People who aren't confident in their own sexuality. I mean, for God's sake, the most likely outcome of this is that a boy who identifies as female will use the girls' restroom or locker room. And in all the women's facilities that I've been in over the years, they have stalls. They have private showers. Women are different from men. And if there's an occasional girl who identifies as a male and wants to use the boys' restroom, then somebody can stand at the door and guard it while that person uses it. Or we can have unisex bathrooms. There are many solutions to this. But the right wing in California has decided that this is their next big thing. And this is a Republican Party that is decimated right now. They do not hold a single statewide constitutional office. Republicans are in the minority in both houses of the legislature to the point of being irrelevant. And the idea that the way to revive the Republican Party is to hate people who have a transgender inclination, or maybe it's more than that, that's really sick, twisted, and sad. Speaking of which, Liz Cheney has dropped out of the Senate race in Wyoming. Enough said. And another example of hate-based Republican politics. Today, without any detail, the Supreme Court blocked further same-sex marriages in Utah, which became, I think, the 18th state, right before Christmas, to move to marriage equality. And, of course, they're really worried about gay plural marriages in Utah. Hey, if it's good enough for straight couples, it ought to be good enough for gay couples. Well, the city of Fallujah has once again fallen under siege, and groups claiming linkage to Al-Qaeda claim that they have taken control of Fallujah. Now, if you recall, Fallujah, that was the site of two bloody, brutal assaults by the United States. We took it, we lost it, and we took it back. 2004, 2005. And it was the last scene of known chemical weapons use by the United States. We used white phosphorus to shake and bake the city of Fallujah. And so now, as the puppet Maliki government is facing the civil war that was suppressed while the U.S. had money and troops on the ground in Iraq, it is sadly inevitable that the country is imploding and that this civil war has once again resumed. The two key questions I have include, where is Muqtada al-Sadr? His Badr Brigade stood down and allowed the U.S. to pacify Iraq from about 2007 until we nominally left at the end of 2009. And number two, be very, very careful. Every time you hear, here's a quote. One senior police official in Anbar said Saturday that Fallujah is completely under the control of Al-Qaeda. The term Al-Qaeda, the brand that it represents, is being widely tossed around. And while certainly there are people who took over Fallujah who have some identity with Al-Qaeda, these are matters of convenience, both on the side of the fighters and on the side of the American media. And it provides this constant backbeat, Al-Qaeda, 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 which is supposed to scare the living daylights out of us here in the U.S. so that we say, spy on us. Really, take all my phone records. Let the FBI move in with me, for God's sake. And it simply isn't true. Al-Qaeda is a diffuse group of people who share some common goals. There isn't much in the way of a central command. The next story I have for you here is Syria. Rebels battle fighters allied with Al-Qaeda. And now, when they say that, they're referring to ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. Just a month ago, when they said forces linked to Al-Qaeda in Syria, it was the Al-Nusra Front. Now, I do understand, and I've said this on many occasions, that it's very complicated in Syria. It's not just the government and the rebels. Those rebels are comprised of a lot of different groups, including mercenaries bought and paid for by Saudi Arabia and other outside groups. But it's not just laziness on the part of our media. There is a conscious spin. And it's like a bad cartoon. We're the good guys, and all the bad guys are in one group called Al-Qaeda. Sorry. I just insist on rational thinking and clear, objective reporting. And of course, those are both in very short supply these days. A couple of interesting people passed away over the weekend. Saul Zentz. He was the founder of Fantasy Records, Fantasy Films, produced One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, The English Patient, many great movies. And he had I believe it's still there, at 10th and Parker in Berkeley, the studios and offices of Fantasy, Milestone, Prestige. Milestone and Prestige were the jazz labels that had incredible performers, legacy artists from the 50s and 60s. Then Zentz dabbled in rock and roll, and Creedence Clearwater Revival was the biggest source of hits at Fantasy Records. But CCR's John Fogerty fell out with Zentz, and they went to court many times. Fogerty was forced by a judge to change the name of a song called Zentz Can't Dance from Zentz to Vance, as if it mattered. And so he was a larger-than-life figure who affected a lot of people and who elevated the literary content of Hollywood movies and the jazz quotient in American music. And we also lost Phil Everly, half of the Everly Brothers, two of the most beautiful harmonizers in American music in my lifetime. They hailed from Kentucky, but didn't live there long. And as Joel Selvin of the San Francisco Chronicle, if I can find the link, I'll post it with this, pointed out in a very moving tribute to Phil Everly, the dirty family secret is that the brothers didn't get along. They hated performing together, and that's why they broke up in the mid-70s. And so digging into the tax-deductible music archives, I want to pull out my all-time favorite Everly Brothers song. I don't believe it was a top 10 hit, but growing up in Cincinnati, just up the Ohio River from Bowling Green, this song's always meant a lot to me.